Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today a very well-known appellate lawyer and all-around good guy, Kevin DeBose from Houston. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Todd. Jody, good to be here.
I mean, everyone knows you today as an appellate lawyer, but you haven't always been an appellate lawyer, have you?
That's right. I always wanted to be a trial lawyer. It started when I was in middle school and joined the debate team and won my first tournament. I decided I should be a lawyer and went through most of school thinking that and most of law school and spent 6 years with a personal injury practice. It was a three-man, mostly insurance defense firm, and tried 25 cases my first 6 years of practice, which would be really hard to do today. And I loved it and hated it. I loved getting up in front of juries and talking. I hated the discovery. I hated fighting with other lawyers over document production, that sort of thing. But what really brought it home to me was about 5 years in, I went through a period where I had really bad stomach aches and problems for about 2 weeks. And I went to doctors and had a bunch of tests run. And they came to me and said, "You're healthy as a horse. The only problem with you is stress." And then about 6 months later, I had chest pains, and my father had recently had a heart attack. So I looked into that and went to a cardiologist, had a bunch of tests run. The answer that came back was, "There's nothing wrong with you but stress." So I thought, well, here I am 30 years old, and my body's already revolting against my career choice. What else can I do? This was in 1985, and there were a couple of appellate specialists around. Jim Cronzer had been around forever, Royal Brin in Dallas, but not many. It wasn't a well-recognized specialty. But I'd always enjoyed appellate advocacy. I was an English major in college. I liked to write. I was on a moot court team in college, in law school, not mock trial. So I sat around and thought about it and thought, well, you know, a lot of trial lawyers really don't like appellate work. They don't like research. They don't enjoy writing. It's hard to find a block of time with a deposition and trial schedule. So I decided to hang out a shingle. I had an extra room in my house with a separate entrance to the outside and started a solo practice. And I wrote a letter to my trial lawyer friends that said, you know, "I know you might not enjoy this kind of stuff. I'm kind of geeky and I do. So why don't you let me take this off your hands? I'll charge you less than you charge your clients. You can make money off of it and I'll do your appellate work." And I sent that out. My test was, if I saw this person at the courthouse, would I speak to them by name and talk to them? And after 6 years of trial practice, I had 140 people on my list.
Wow.
I sent out the letter on a Monday, and I got my first call on Friday of that week. That's how I made the transition.
That's a smart way to do it. We should mention, I mean, we just kind of jumped right into your early career, but you practice today with, I think what folks would agree generally is, I mean, it's the largest appellate boutique firm in Texas with a whole slew of board certified civil appellate lawyers and a couple of ex-chief justices. I mean, where you are now, I mean, it seems like to me that's kind of the upper echelon of appellate practice. And so it's really interesting to hear how you go from, you know, 30-year-old trial lawyer who's really struggling to deal with the stress to where you are now. I wanted to kind of get it out there early that, you know, you're here because not only because of your experience, but just you really have, you're in the practice point where a lot of appellate lawyers kind of aspire to be. And so you're a great example of, you know, your career is really the long game, right? It's not what happens to you super early in your career.
Yeah. And I was real fortunate to be at the right place at the right time on several occasions to kind of get in on the ground floor when the specialty first started. Like I said, in 85, I started my solo practice and struggled. I am not a great business person. I'm not a good marketer. I was in practice for 2 years. And the second year, I kind of hooked up with one trial lawyer and worked for him half time and did his appellate work. So I'd have some regular income stream. But the real lucky break was in 87. I was an adjunct professor at University of Houston Law Center in legal writing, which is a very, very part-time job. And I was out there and ran into a friend, old friend of mine on the parking lot. She said, "What are you doing out here?" And I told her, and she said, "Well, you know, our director of legal research and writing is about to retire. We need somebody else. Would you be interested?" I said, well, sure. And I ended up interviewing for that job and getting hired. And they were great because they told me, "This is a half-time position, and we strongly encourage you to find something else with the other half-time." So I approached a guy named Jim Perdue, who's a famous medical malpractice lawyer. And Jim was a big alumnus of the University of Houston. And he kind of perceived what I was doing as being a public service for his law school. And I tried a big case against Jim, and he got a $1 million verdict. He liked the way that I handled it strategically on my end. And I went to him and talked to him and said, "What would you think about an appellate lawyer?" They had 9 PI plaintiff trial lawyers, no appellate lawyers. None of them liked to do appellate work. So they let me become their appellate lawyer on a half-time basis. So every day I would go to work there in the morning and go to the law school in the afternoon. And started out as director of legal research and writing. Then I became director of appellate advocacy, which meant that I taught an appellate advocacy class and coached moot court teams. But I really enjoyed doing both. I always told people that I think teaching makes you a better practitioner and practicing makes you a better teacher. So I did that for 7 years. But finally got to a point where I kind of felt like I'd got what I wanted out of the teaching. Firm was going fine, but I was reaching a point where most of my work was coming from outside the firm rather than just doing the firm's appeals. They were so good, most of their cases settled. People were afraid to go to court against them. So one day I was having lunch with some friends, and one of them was Jennifer Hogan, and her husband Richard was practicing with David Holman. And she said, "You ought to talk to Richard and David." And I did, and ended up going to work with them in an appellate boutique that started out Richard and David and I. A year later, we hired Roger Townsend and Jennifer Hogan when they left Fulbright. And then later on, we hired David Gunn when Jim Croninger retired. And we hired a couple of lawyers fresh out of clerkships named Russell Post and Brett Busby. So it was really kind of an all-star team that just kind of grew organically. So yeah, I felt really fortunate to be at the right place at the right time for that.
You know, it's interesting to think about being the director of research and writing in a law school on only a half-time basis. You know, now I feel like there's such an emphasis on that. It's kind of funny that was the case, you know, when you did that 30 years ago.
Yeah, and the way it worked with the legal research part of the course, I would lecture the whole first year class once a week, and then they broke up into small groups taught by student TAs, and I supervised them. And then the legal writing part of the course, they broke up into small groups and were taught by lawyers as adjunct professors. Hmm. So, I did get to teach a huge room auditorium once a week, but the actual hands-on teaching was done by other people. But I helped design the curriculum and work with and coach the teachers on both levels. And I really enjoyed it. It was a fun job.
That's really neat. I'm a U of H law cougar, so that's near and dear to my heart.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
When I was, while I was teaching, I had an argument on a really big case for Jim Perdue in the first court of appeals. And the other side had retained Dean Keaton from UT Law School. His name was on their brief. And when I went to the oral argument, I told my students about the argument, because I said, some of you may want to come watch an oral argument. And so some of them came, and they were going up on an elevator with about 10 students and the two lawyers from the other side. And they saw these law students, and they said, "Well, did you come to see Dean Keaton?" Because it turned out he was sick and couldn't come that day. And the students all said, "Dean Keaton, who's that? We came to see Kevin DuBose." No, scripted it better.
That's perfect. And they all got extra points on their exam at the end of the year.
That's right.
That's great. So in some of our early communications about getting you on the show, you mentioned 1987 being a watershed year. I'm not sure if you mean it was a watershed year because that was the year.
That was in 94.
94. Okay.
87 was the year I left my failed solo practice and went to the law school and Jim Perdue. But I really mean 87 was a watershed year for the practice, the appellate bar in Texas, because three significant things happened. That was the year they first offered a board certification in civil law. And I took the test the first year. I've always wondered who graded that test the first year when everybody seemed to be taking it. And then the appellate section of the state bar started. I think Ralph Brock was our first chair. Then it was called the appellate practice and advocacy section. It's now been shortened to the appellate section. But that started in 87. And then the first state bar advanced appellate law course was offered in 87. So, that's kind of what makes our culture is the section, the course, and the certification, and those all happen the same year.
Mm-hmm. That really is. I think of those things now and just think, well, they've always been there, but
yeah.
Clearly they weren't. And board certification had to start somewhere, and the section two started that same year. But that really is an amazing.
Aware of the significance of those things happening at the same time. It was just, let's do this, and it happened.
No, that's an incredible convergence of things that now I think we sort of take for granted.
You do. And then you were actually chair of the appellate section at one point, correct?
Yeah, I chaired the section in 95, 96. And the section kind of started out with a bang, but it kind of slowed down a little bit the 2 years before me. We had a chair 1 year whose wife was being treated for cancer, and that appropriately became his focus. We had our first board meeting about a month before the end of his term because we had our annual meeting coming up and we had to. But that was kind of a lost year. The next year, the chair was a sitting Court of Appeals justice who didn't really have a staff person that could help out with a lot of the clerical stuff. So that was kind of a slow year. And when I started my year, I had four initiatives. And at that point, I think the section only had like one or two committees. And I formed four new committees. One of them was the Appellate Pro Bono Committee, because I knew there were people that needed more appeals and people that needed lawyers and couldn't afford them. So I thought we could have a committee to join those two groups up, and that committee is still operating and flourishing. We also had a committee that conducted one of the first appellate surveys and surveyed all the judges in the state to ask their thoughts about brief writing and oral advocacy and all the things we speculated about what they wanted, but tried to get a definitive answer, which has now become kind of a cottage industry for Haynes and Boone, and they do it much better. But we formed a committee that year and did the first survey. We also formed a committee to write a Texas appellate practice manual. The first one of those was done single-handedly by Don Hunt in 1976. The second version was done in 93. Roger Townsend was the editor-in-chief, and he had contributing editors who wrote the 16 chapters. It was a massive project, and within a year after it was published, the court decided to revamp the appellate rules and render the manual obsolete.
Oh, the 97 change.
Yeah. Doing a new version of the manual that would get caught up. And we went a long way down the road that year. And before the end of the year, the State Bar Publications Division told us they didn't think a manual would be profitable. The last one didn't sell very well. There were already O'Connor's books, and Orsinger had a book, and Lane Carlson had a book. And they pulled the plug on that. But the fourth committee was the committee to look into what we then called, there was a Texas lawyer's creed, and somebody said, maybe we should have an appellate lawyer's creed. And we set up a committee that eventually drafted what became the standards for appellate conduct. So those were the four committees, and they all worked out really well, except for the one whose project got canceled. and I was on the appellate section council again 20 years later, and there were like 20 committees.
Oh yeah.
It's great. They all do wonderful work. But it just almost makes my head swim. And I think, boy, this is a monster that somebody created a long time ago.
And you were there at the beginning when it was just a few people around the table and one committee.
That's right.
Something like that. Gosh. I'm a little surprised, I guess, that the State Bar, I mean, I understand the profitability issue, but, you know, certainly since that decision to pull an appellate practice manual, that gap has been filled. you mentioned O'Connor's, I believe, and then of course your partner, Robert DeBose, and then some other folks in your firm put together a pretty comprehensive, I don't want to call it an appellate practice manual, but that's pretty much what it is. I mean, it's a great resource.
Yeah, we divided that up, and almost everybody in the firm at the time wrote a chapter. And we really wanted to submit it as just a book by our law firm, but our publisher insisted that one person be identified with it. So Robert either drew the black bean or got lucky, depending on how you look at it. So his name and picture show up on all the advertisements, but it was very much a firm project.
Yeah, I'm holding it in my hands here. It's the Texas Practitioner's Guide to Civil Appeals, 2016. And Robert's photo is on the back cover. So Robert has definitely gotten some mileage out of this, I would imagine. But
I tell people we hired a male model for that picture.
But, but it's something that I just went and pulled it off the shelf. I mean, I keep it close by, and although I will admit to also referring to O'Connor's pretty regularly.
Sure. I do too. I think it's a very valuable resource.
You know, you have an interesting perspective being a trial lawyer and then an appellate lawyer and kind of practicing in both of those courts in different capacities. Can you kind of tell us some of the differences and things that you learned in both of those roles that you apply to the other?
It's hard to say this without sounding somewhat judgmental because I'm very much an appellate lawyer now and not a trial lawyer. Trial lawyers tend to be a little bit more aggressive and combative, passionate, zealous, and probably so. I mean, they cling to the part of the disciplinary rules of the rules of disciplinary conduct that say a lawyer shall zealously represent the interests of their client, and they should. I sometimes think that they're a little bit too zealous, and certainly the appellate culture is different from that. Most of the people that I try appeals against are my friends, and we have a good relationship and argue passionately in the courtroom and then go across the street and have a drink at the bar. Years ago, I had an appeal against David Gunn, and after the appeal, this was before the days of email even, but he faxed me a cartoon that was a bunch of medieval knights on horseback with lances, and they were standing around after the battle, all beating their lances on the ground saying, "Good battle, good battle." And he sent me that right after an argument. That's kind of the way that appellate lawyers are. I don't think that's because only jerks go into trial law and all the really enlightened, lovely people go into appellate law. It has a lot to do with what their roles are in the justice system, because in the trials court, you're still trying to adjudicate facts and trying to persuade a jury that your version of the story is right. And so I won't say you have to make personal attacks, but undermining the credibility of the messenger on the other side is kind of part of the deal. Mm-hmm. And it's not that that's completely untrue in the appellate courts, but in the appellate courts, the facts have already been found, and it's a lot easier to take a dispassionate view of applying the law to the facts that have been found than it is in the trial court. People in the trial court also, and I worked on both sides of the personal injury scene, first as a defense lawyer when I was trying cases, and then on the plaintiff side when I worked for Jim Perdue. In personal injury, more so than in commercial law, there are very distinct sides. Commercial law often depends on who gets to the courthouse first as to whether you're plaintiff or defendant. But in personal injury, people on both sides are real true believers. And they're not just posturing. Plaintiff's lawyers really do think that insurance companies and insurance company lawyers are greedy people, and they're mean-spirited, and they don't want to ever see any plaintiff recover a penny, which is obviously untrue. And defense lawyers think that every plaintiff is a fraud that really hasn't been hurt, and the plaintiff's lawyers are just greedy and want to run up the damages because they get 40% of it. And the truth is, there are people on both sides that bend the rules a little bit, and there are people that are really upstanding, fine, ethical lawyers. But it's hard for people who are in the arena to see that, and much more so in the appellate arena, where people do tend to work both sides of the docket. And like I say, the facts have already been determined. So I just think it's a much more courteous and respectful culture than what you find in the trial court.
That's definitely true. And I'm going to share a little personal anecdote here. It seems like a good place to do it. When I was a young, really wet behind the ears appellate lawyer, I was finally given a case, my very own case, to brief and handle as I saw fit under the supervision of the good folks I worked with at Fulbright and Jaworski, primarily Ben Taylor. And my opposing counsel in that case turned out to be a fellow by the name of Kevin DeBose. And so you probably, I know you don't remember the case because it's been a long time ago, but I had the privilege of briefing a case against you. And, you know, the way that we didn't really interact personally that much. I think I maybe asked you for an extension or two, which wouldn't surprise anyone. But it was a really tragic case involving an injured child, and originated from down there in Houston. But I got the privilege of handling the briefing, and I got to see what the work product was like coming out of from an experienced appellate lawyer in Houston who, as I say, we didn't interact a ton, but when we did, it was, you know, the kind of interaction you just described. It was, you know, courteous and sure, if you need an extension, you know, no problem. And you didn't even treat me like I was a baby lawyer. So I thought, you know, I figured at some point in this conversation, I needed to work that in that, you know, I've been doing this now since, well, I was at Fulbright starting in 1997. So, you know, it's been a few years. So that it's fun for me to kind of recapture that, recount that, and just, you know, reiterate to the listeners that that's the kind of, you know, you really are living out what you talk about. I mean, and what you say about appellate lawyers is true. Some of my best friends are folks I've had on the other side of cases.
Yeah.
And we've said on this show before how much, you know, how appellate law really is a superior form of litigation. And we can all nod our heads in agreement on that again. And there will be people who disagree with us, but it really is. I mean, it even goes back, Kevin, I think, to what you were saying at the beginning about, you know, that your physical manifestations of the stress of being a trial lawyer. This is not a job that lacks stress, what we do for a living, but it's just different. It's just a different kind of stress.
It really is. And most of the times our deadlines can be managed. You know, mandamuses are the obvious exception to that. I recently had a case in worked on a case in the Supreme Court where briefs on the merits were requested and each side had 48 hours to draft what turned out to be 70, 75 page briefs. So yeah, you occasionally run into that stressful situation. Most of the times deadlines are manageable. And part of the reason for that is that appellate lawyers are really good about agreeing to extension. Mm-hmm. And some of the most stressful situations I have are when I have clients that don't want me to. Mm-hmm. And have to talk clients into allowing me to be the kind of lawyer I want to be.
That's very true. Well, and you know, Todd and I have talked about this before, but also kind of explaining that you can oppose an extension in an appellate court, but unless there's real extenuating circumstances, you're almost never going to do anything but look bad to the court over it. And so communicating that to a client who doesn't have that lens to look through is always a difficult conversation.
Yeah, that's what I often mention. I can't just tell them that it's not the right thing to do. That's unlikely to sell them. But when I say we are going to lose, they will get the extension and we'll just look like we're being obstructionists to the court. And we don't want that. They often come around.
And they have, in the beginning, at least, until they hear you say that, they have a really hard time understanding why shouldn't we oppose that? We're giving ground. We shouldn't give ground on this.
Yeah, that's really one of the biggest obstacles.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
And another way that I define the difference between trial lawyers and appellate lawyers, trial lawyers almost always think everything they say is right and everything the other side says is wrong. Mm-hmm. And appellate lawyers are much more capable, again, because of the procedural difference in where you are in the pipeline, but appellate lawyers are much more inclined to say, you know, we're just never going to win that point and I'm going to drop it rather than making the argument and looking silly and losing credibility on my good argument. And sometimes when I go to trial court sometimes as the appellate consultant, And sometimes people insist that I argue things that I don't really think are worthwhile arguments. And there's a way to telegraph to the judge that this is not one I'm really planting my flag on. And that way, when I do pick an argument that I really do dig in on, they know that that has a lot more credibility than somebody. You know, if you say that you ought to win on every point, the judge realizes that it's no longer about truth or justice, that you're a true believer in your side and you will say anything to get the result that you want. And if you instead convince the court that you've got discretion and you're only going to push on the stuff that is really true, it just pumps up your credibility phenomenal.
Yep. I mean, even every time you see the brief come across that has 15 issues, you have to ask yourself, well, what, which ones of those are actually issues and which ones of those are just things that are thrown in because somebody's mad about it, which is usually the case.
When I used to teach legal writing, what I would tell my students about that is imagine you're a judge reading a brief, and most people try to put their best arguments first. That's a good strategy. Mm-hmm. And they've read through, say there's 15 points of error. And they've read through 14 and they're not convinced by any of them. Finally, they get to your 15th best argument. They're suddenly going to go, all right, first now, not going to happen. My old partner, Roger Townsend, talks about the Texaco Pencil case where there were 100 points in error.
Yeah, thank goodness the rules have changed a little bit and the courts have become more forgiving on how you state your issues and what's included with that. Because, oh gosh.
Yeah.
To that point, Kevin, I subscribe to the view that if you can't win in about the first three issues, you're not going to win. Do you have the same perspective?
I do. I rarely file a brief with more than three issues. I kind of like two better than three. But I think if you look at my briefs, you'll find a fair number of issue briefs. But I'm confident that at least over the last 20, 30 years, you won't find any with seven or eight. Just don't do it.
I will put an asterisk on that, and I agree with you. The only times I've done separately is where you have a case that has just some weird procedural complexity, and you have to challenge some things you might not otherwise challenge to avoid the whole, well, they didn't challenge every ground, so you can just go ahead and affirm.
Yeah.
Those are the cases where you do it, and you hate to do it, but you know you don't have a choice either.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, yeah, summary judgment. I mean, if you've lost a summary judgment and the court has not stated its grounds and the summary judgment had 10 issues or 10 grounds, you have no choice in that situation.
And sometimes I group those together under a Roman numeral just to avoid the appearance to the court. Oh, my God. We've
got face all here comes this thing.
Right. Sometimes you just have to.
I don't really want to do this, y'all, but I've got to. Here's how I soften it a little bit. Right. That's great. Well, so we talked about when you were working in the first appellate boutique firm that you were in with.
It started out with me and David Holman and Richard Hogan, and then Roger Townsend and Jennifer Hogan joined us.
Right.
Then David Gunn, then Russell Pose, then Brett Busby.
I mean, these are all people that folks in the appellate bar know and know well. But since then, I mean, there's been some evolution to your practice. And the firm you're with now, Alexander DeBose and Jefferson is the name of the firm. But talk to us a little bit about the firm specifically and how you got in with that group and how things have progressed.
So our other firm was starting to come apart at the seams. We ended up splitting. There were seven of us. We went to four different law firms. And Roger Townsend and I had aligned with each other. We were going to do something together. We were thinking about starting our own appellate firm. And Doug Alexander was good friends with my wife in the mid-70s, before he went to law school, before she went to dental school. They worked together at the City of Houston Public Health Department. And when I met her, she told me about her friend Doug. And then I got to know Doug, and we did some family vacations together and knew him on a social level. And I remember one time being on a beach trip, we were walking on the beach and he said, he was at Brown McCarroll doing international business. And he said, so let me get this straight. At your firm, you do nothing but appellate work? How does that work? How do you get into that? And I talked to him a little bit and the rest is history. But Doug and I had remained friends, and he came to our house one night for a dinner party to honor some out of town guests. And he and I ended up in the kitchen and he said, you might be interested to know, Woody Jones and I are about to leave Scott Douglas and form our own firm in Austin. And I said, well, that's great. Congratulations. And I don't think I can't remember whether I told him about Roger, because Roger and I decided to leave, but I had a Supreme Court argument coming up and I didn't have time to deal with all the fallout. So I said, let's wait to announce until after my argument. So I may or may not have told Doug, but the next day I went to the office and I told Roger, I saw Doug Alexander last night. Guess what? He and Woody Jones are leaving Scott Douglas. And Roger comes to see me a few minutes later and he has this master plan. He said, I think we ought to have a firm with offices in Dallas, Houston, and Austin, and have a couple of people in each city. And we can work independently and make our own decisions about overhead and stuff, but work together on cases. And, you know, let's approach them and work this out. So we did with Doug and Woody. Our Dallas plan at the time was Deborah Hankinson. And she had just left the court and taught at SMU for a semester. And she was practicing with Betsy Whitaker. And we talked to them about being our Austin. Well, the two of them had a blow up. And Deborah decided she didn't want to have any partners ever again. She wanted to be Deborah Hankinson and Associates, which she did pretty well for a long time. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have a Dallas office for about 5 years, but we opened in Houston and Austin. And then we later added a Dallas office with LaDon Conway and Charlie Frazier. And we gradually added people over the years. We did not hire any fresh out of law school associates. Tried to hire people that already established a reputation in the appellate bar. But the biggest shot in the arm we got was in 2013 when Chief Justice Wallace Jefferson stepped down from the Texas Supreme Court and decided to join us. He had a lot of offers, obviously, most from big firms. But he'd been with an appellate boutique before he went on the court with Crofts, Callaway, and Jefferson. And that's really what he wanted to do. And we were able to persuade him to join us. And that was a big shot in the arm. And that same year, Marcy Greer joined us from Fulbright. And those two things together kind of had an impact that has sustained us ever since.
Well, we would be remiss, too, if we didn't ask you about your recent experience arguing over Zoom before the Texas Supreme Court. That hasn't been that long ago that happened, but I've seen that the court has already issued the opinion in the case. Tell us about what it was like to be a pioneer, a technological pioneer for someone who tells me he's really not a tech person.
It's true, I'm not. I had a little bit of a leg up. I'm on a couple of national boards that started meeting by Zoom last fall, mainly just because it's cheaper than people from all over the country flying somewhere. And I was terrible at it first. The first couple of Zoom meetings I joined by phone because I was afraid of the technology and my desktop didn't have a microphone and camera. I soon figured out that my laptop did. But I was used to using Zoom. So the technology I was very comfortable with. We were scheduled for an argument on March 23rd. And about March 10th, we got an email from the court saying, we're shutting down. And we were the next case up to be argued. They didn't handpick our case for the first Zoom case. We were just the first one up. And a couple of weeks later, they decided to try Zoom. So they went back to their docket and we were the first ones up. And Tom Wright was on the other side. And they sent an email to Tom and I on April 1st saying, how would you like to argue this case on April 8th? Tom and I both admitted later that the thought ran through our mind, wait a minute, this is April 1st. This is an April Fool's joke. But it wasn't. And the next thought that ran through our mind is, wait, the rules say you get 3 weeks notice. What about that? But my client was hurt in 2011 and the trial was in 2015. And I thought, if we say no to this and they put us back at the line until they start live arguments again, who knows when he'll get his case argued. So I agreed, and I usually like to take 2 or 3 weeks to get ready for a Supreme Court argument. But having 1 week to do it, you tend to compress things much more. And I really did find it was sufficient. I was worried at first that that would not be enough to get on top of things. But I did, and Blake Hawthorne, the clerk of the court, was great. The argument was on Wednesday. We had a practice session with him on Friday to look at our backgrounds, our lighting and the audio, and talked about tips for how to do it. He went over what kind of cues we would get and that sort of thing. The day of the argument, we did the same thing with him for about 15 minutes before the argument. I wasn't sure at first. I thought that the court might be together on one camera, but of course they were social distancing too. So they were all calling in from their homes or offices. And really once the argument started, I completely forgot about the technology and it became, just a regular Supreme Court argument, which is daunting enough in itself, but I really didn't have any trouble with it at all. I'd say I didn't have any trouble. My one complaint was, I've always been very sensitive. I've always been told not to talk over judges. And when you hear someone start to talk, you need to shut down immediately and listen to their answer. And Zoom has this characteristic where the person that's talking, this yellow box lights up around their screen. Well, other things can cause that to happen, like rustling papers or clearing your throat or any kind of noise. So there were a couple of times during the argument where one of the justices' box lit up, and I thought, sure, they were talking. So I stopped dead in my tracks. And one time, at least, I know that I looked at Justice Boyd and said, Justice Boyd, did you have a question? And he said, no, I don't. And he ended up being the lone dissenting vote against me. So I don't know if that was why. If it was, of course, it wasn't. But that was one little small glitch. But other than that, I could see everyone fine. I could hear everyone fine. A couple of weeks later, there was an article that came out in the New York Times called Zoom is Terrible. That was the title and very much the theme. And they said that it causes anxiety and awkwardness and fatigue. And you know, people say after several Zoom meetings in a row, oh, I'm so tired, I'm Zoomed out. Well, that would be true after several meetings in a row. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got defensive. I feel like people are attacking my friend or something. I am so thankful that we have Zoom during this period. I mean, I'm using everything. And I can't imagine what this shutdown period would have been like if we didn't have Zoom. And especially oral argument. I know a lot of courts are only doing telephone audio conference arguments. I can't imagine what that would be like.
That seems like a far worse platform, especially in a case like the Supreme Court where you have 9 judges and you can't see any of them trying to coordinate. That just seems like a mess.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan. I think it's a great device and maybe it can be perfected a little bit, but I didn't have any trouble with it at all.
It's like a lot of other things. I mean, we're sort of being forced to use the technology to make up for where we're lacking in other areas right now. And so we've talked a little on the show about, you know, what's the new normal really going to look like once we're through the issues with COVID-19. I think it's still open, you know, for discussion about what role Zoom is going to play. But it seems like the door is certainly open to Zoom playing a role going forward, whereas it would have been really difficult to envision the Supreme Court or our courts of appeals just routinely having Zoom or, you know, video oral arguments.
Yeah. I think I would always favor live argument if it's possible. But if for any reason it's not, I would agree to a Zoom argument in a heartbeat any day.
And it really does kind of open some access to justice issues that maybe have impaired people both in the trial courts and appellate courts. And hopefully that's something that when all of this is over and we return to whatever normal is, will be one of those lasting legacies of this, is that it gets people more ability to get into court and get their cases heard in ways that they couldn't before.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I'd be perfectly happy if that's the way it worked out. You know, if a case gets docket equalized to another court of appeals a long way off, like El Paso. I mean, I love El Paso, but if that was an obstacle for somebody to travel that far and they requested and the court offered a Zoom platform, I'd be happy to do that.
Well, before we wrap up, we always like to ask our guests if they have a tip or a war story that they'd like to share for our listeners. Do you have something you'd like to, you've given us a lot of great tips and things already, but do you have another one you'd like to share here at the end?
Well, the first thing that did come to mind is a couple of humorous anecdotes, because they are so few and far between in appellate law.
We'd love to hear those.
Absolutely.
That's the reason why on TV you see trial law a lot, but very seldom appellate law, because it's not a rich subject. But there are two stories I always tell, and they're both true. One is, it was in the Austin Court of Appeals, and I can't remember who the justices were, but story is that there was a client who was arguing, it was a lawyer arguing his first appeal and was very nervous. There was a question came about the relief that was requested. And the judge picked up the brief and flipped to the last page of the brief. And there was no heading on the brief that said prayer for relief. And so the justice was kind of confused and said to the lawyer, counsel, you don't have a prayer. And the lawyer said, I know, judge, I'm just doing the best that I can. And then the other one was in the one of the Houston Courts of Appeals. I can't remember if it's the first or 14th. And there, again, a young lawyer arguing their first case, very nervous. They said, they started their argument by saying, I've got 4 points I want to make for the court. And they went through the first one, and the court wasn't convinced. They went to the second one, court wasn't convinced. So one of the justices tried to cut things short and said, okay, counsel, what's 3 and 4? And the lawyer said, 7. And then immediately said, I'm sorry. But yeah, true stories, a little bit of appellate humor.
I like that.
Yeah. That's great. Well, Kevin, thanks again for being with us. Just I wanted to mention before we go that we wanted to acknowledge and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. If you need a supersedious bond, Court Surety is a great resource for that. And of course, everyone knows about Thomson Reuters and their online research resources that are available for legal research and all kinds of other things that even go far beyond what appellate lawyers need. So check out our post on this episode at techsapplawpod.com for more information about our sponsors.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at techsapplawpod.com or on Twitter at @techsapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.